This is Sidebar, where we break away from the echo chamber to give you the inside track on the latest legal issues and trends in business, law, and society, and predict what they mean for your future.
Hello, and welcome to the sixth and final episode of Sidebar's Future of Litigation season. I'm Ed Spencer, Disputes and Investigations Senior Associate at Taylor Wessing, and in this episode, I'm going to consider what evidence looks like in the digital age with fellow Senior Associate Jesse Prynne and the eDisclosure Information Project's Chris Dale. Let's jump into the conversation now.
Chris, thank you for joining us today. As someone who's been immersed in disclosure for decades, first as a practitioner, but now as an industry commentator, I suppose to kick off, it would be useful for you to set the scene slightly. In litigation, as we know, evidence is made up of what the witnesses recall, but also the other key component is what the documents show. So can you briefly give us an overview of how you've seen the concept of what a document is, how it's evolved over time?
The definition of a document has stayed more or less constant, anything on which information of any kind is recorded. What's changed is the different media on which documents, whether they be something that's a facsimile of a document as we always understood it, or an electronic one, has changed. When I began, he says, sounding like something out of the ark, it wasn't disclosure, it was discovery, and it was all paper. My abiding memory of it all is about 3 days short of the expiry of a final order for discovery, being shown in a basement about 20 feet of shelving and told, oh, we think there may be some documents in there that matter. And that's sort of fixed my impression, my understanding, my recollection of what discovery was all about, rushing around trying to reduce paper to lists. We did it, I have to say, but only just. The evolution from there went first, I suppose, to everybody having a company-issued computer on their desk, centrally controlled, tightly controlled by IT, so that both the creation of documents and their recovery, if they were needed, although it seemed hard at the time, I think, now looks very easy compared with what we've moved on to. BYOD, bring your own device, changes of a few years back caused a great stir because for the first time, people could bypass IT with a device that they owned and controlled and over which the company didn't necessarily have any right of access. Even those days now seem quite peaceful and relaxed compared to what we have now, where everybody has multiple devices. Data is not stored somewhere conveniently that everyone can get to, but is on the cloud somewhere, perhaps, where achieving backups or copies from other people's devices, never mind your own as a company, is increasingly difficult. Needless to say, the rules have had to evolve to match that. Whether they've done so successfully is a different matter. But that's a sort of a brief overview, I think, of how we've got to where we are.
Thank you. And Jesse, to pick up on what Chris has alluded to, sort of the, as you mentioned, the bring your own device started sort of the device explosion. But obviously, over the last year, now more than a year, we've all had to change to remote working, more devices. How sort of have you seen that from your practice change, and how do you think it impacts where the evidence might be for future disputes?
Well, Ed, I certainly think it impacts where documents and evidence may be for future disputes. So I think the pandemic, first, it probably means that we are all using more devices and we're using more communications platforms on more devices. So whether we're doing calls by Skype, Teams, Zoom, WhatsApping, both colleagues and clients, also using obviously Teams and Skype to instant message. So I definitely think it means a plethora of data sources which are being used more frequently. And I think I've already had some queries coming from clients to do with recorded calls, for example. So where a client has recorded a call and then may or may not have informed the other side that that call was being recorded and then is wondering whether they can, should rely on that call. And I think that in particular is an interesting change that we are going to see in terms of digital evidence. And I think that's an issue that what's happening now is obviously what will be considered in future disputes, which may come up in the next 5+ years. And that will be that calls have been recorded, whether known or unknown, and there may be relevant evidence in those calls, which parties in due course will want to rely on. And I think that gives rise to quite a few issues, which will be no doubt unpicked in the coming years. But also there's an interesting irony from that, which is that whereas, you know, particularly as solicitors, we are meant to be very diligent about our attendance notes, and I'm sure we all are, and where you just previously had a conference call with none of the video or recording capability, or certainly if there was a recording capability, it wasn't commonly used, everyone was taking their attendance notes, or at least one or two people on the call. Well, now, if you're doing a video call and expected to participate, you may well not be taking very substantive notes because it's actually very difficult to do that. So the best record of that call may well be a video recording of it. And that's likely to give rise to some interesting developments in digital evidence.
There's interesting aspects of that. One is whether a Zoom message, that's a button that says recording, glimmering in the top corner of a Zoom window or Skype window or whatever, whether that serves as notice to everybody who's taking part that they're being recorded, or whether you still ought to say expressly, this is being recorded. The other interesting point to me that arises from that is, who knows if it's being recorded? Who knows where it's being recorded? Who's going to be able to remember to think about it a year later or whatever? And are you going to be able to find it anyway? All sorts of different things arise from this very sudden, overnight effectively, transition from fairly formal conference calls or whatever they were to apparently informal Zoom and similar and Teams calls.
I think that makes a good point. There's nothing inherently wrong with recordings existing, leaving aside the privacy points. It's interesting that once they do exist, they're a document, they're potentially relevant to a dispute. But as Chris said, sort of knowing that they exist is one thing, or that they might exist. Knowing where they are, how they can be searched, how are they catalogued is interesting. And I think that's where the point about sort of how these changes that were forced upon us have to, internal policy has to sort of catch up with this and account for it, because we're not going to necessarily have the same sources of evidence that we used to have for disputes in the future that arise now.
It's very easy to say, as one does, oh, you need policies to govern this. Every organization ought to have rules and policies to cover all these circumstances. This happened overnight. I know it was now 13 months ago, but the opportunities for people to develop policies at a time when they were worried about whether people were actually going to call in at all is one of those things that sounds great when you say it, but sounds less impressive to people who are seeking advice on the subject. However, 13 months has passed, 14 months has passed, and my guess is that the problems that you talked about, Ed, are only just about to start appearing, coming through as discovery issues.
And so as Chris, as someone sort of, and Jesse to some extent as well, as people who are at the coalface like me of these sort of things, how do you think companies and in-house teams sort of need to be preparing for this potential future of litigation that we're possibly sort of on the cusp of? As you mentioned, Chris, sort of 13, 14 months ago, we'll probably shortly be coming across the first pandemic agreements, which were wholly negotiated in this remote world.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that no doubt we, Ed, as practitioners will have to think about with others, of course, in the future is ensuring that when asking clients about where relevant documents may be, that is as comprehensive as possible. Now, as we might come on to talk about, there's then always the question as to proportionality in relation to the dispute, the nature of it, size of it, number of individuals involved. But at least at the outset, where you're trying to map where all the relevant evidence may be, I think for the future, we're going to have to think about ensuring that for individuals, for employees, for example, so for organisations, they inquire not only as to whether the employee may have relevant evidence in their work email inbox, but also Were they using other messaging platforms, WhatsApp and others, for example, with these individuals? Did they use Teams messaging with the individuals in question? Were they also, as we've just discussed, were they likely to be recording calls? And were they using their personal devices as well as their work devices if, for example, they were out on their allowed dog walk when the relevant call came in? Was that taken on a personal phone rather than their work phone, for example? So we will need to think about how best to effectively kind of list out all the potential places in which relevant digital evidence could be held. And then in terms of collection, that obviously comes down, I mean, not only to the practical way in which it's done, but also as to, as discussed, what's proportionate to collect. But I think we are going to have to think about a more fulsome checklist based on what our working practices of the last 13 months have been, to try and make sure that we do consider everything with clients.
The policies point has always been important, but given how short the notice was of this, I wonder how many organizations did, in fact, very quickly develop some rules. By all means, use Zoom or don't use Zoom, as the case may be. If you use Zoom, are you recording? If you're recording it, are you telling people you're recording it? If you're recording it, do you know how to retrieve it? Will you even remember you did it? All those sorts of things put enormous pressure on organizations at the beginning of the pandemic. My sense is that an awful lot of them had better things, as they saw it then, probably rightly, to do and still have, but we haven't actually advanced as much as we should have done in terms of that capture of information and knowing where things are. Quite apart from your point, Jesse, about the lawyers remembering to ask in the context of an actual collection.
So I think sort of prudent, as Jesse mentioned, as Chris picked up on, prudent probably for clients to at this point be considering, if they haven't already, updating some of the information governance and retention policies, at least to sort of make a note of what people were using at this time before we probably go back to the offices or a hybrid working environment, such that in years down the line, it doesn't rely on necessarily people who remembering, well, what were you working on? I can certainly look around here and I've got my an iPad, a couple of phones, my work laptop. And certainly, I imagine if you ask me in a year's time, oh, what were you working on? I'd forget one of those probably.
The other thing about pandemic is that people now separated from the people they used to work with, unable to just wander down the corridor and ask questions or shout across a partition or whatever, have had to resort to other ways of communicating internally, not mind externally. Like water finding its own level, communication will find the easiest route to get the job done, get the communication over. And employers can be as prescriptive as they like. You will only communicate by this means or that. In practice, very often anyway, the more they close down the alternative routes and insist on a particular route, the faster people will find an alternative that works for them, not necessarily with bad intent, just to, as I say, get the job done.
I think that's an interesting point as well, because it's sort of the company might have a policy, but your counterpart may do what they want anyway. I know I've seen sort of an explosion in the last year or so of clients who, because they're now used to talk, maybe ringing me on my mobile or using their mobile, they will just send a WhatsApp message. And the challenge there is making sure that, well, you can back it up. It is backed up. Where's it backed up? Especially obviously from our point of view, it's largely the sort of legal advice points. But for clients who are possibly negotiating contracts and where questions or points come in, which could be key, making sure that even if it's a work device, making sure it's backed up is an interesting point.
You're listening to Sidebar. Subscribe now for the inside track on the latest legal issues and trends in business, law, and society, and what they mean for your future.
There's a conflict between the informality, which Zoom and the rest of it tends to bring to us. Everybody's dressed informally, they're at home, they're in a different sort of mode. They could as well be negotiating a very significant contract in that mode, and yet somehow not be switched on to all the things they would be switched on to if they were sitting in an office in formal surroundings and formal clothes.
So I suppose moving on slightly, but still sticking with this sort of more, not niche sources, but sort of developing sources of potentially relevant information. Chris, I know you're a keen photographer, and although photographs aren't necessarily considered or even important in frequently in cases, I think the point about hidden information in photographs, which I know you can talk to, is quite a nice example of how novel information sources can sometimes make or break a case.
Yes, and one of the interesting things about that to me is that the thing on the face of the photograph, the actual picture, is very often the least important part of it. Where it was taken and when may actually be more significant than what the photograph actually shows. If you take all those celebrities worried about photographs of themselves in compromising states of dress or whatever, if it were me, I'd be more worried about when it was taken and where, who's flat, who's whatever, than what I was wearing or not wearing. It's at least as in. There's one case I particularly like where that feeds through into as commercial a set of circumstances as you could wish for, a shipping one called, I think, the Kairos, where photographs were taken of a ship as it sunk, and because it spent a long time sinking. And the naval architects and experts and others who looked at it drew certain conclusions from the photographs as to the sinking. Halfway through the trial, eighth day of the trial, the metadata turned up for the photographs, which had not been produced hitherto. And once the metadata was added to the photographs, that shuffled them into a different order. And once they were in that different order, the true sequence of events, the experts changed their view as to what had happened. And the court's eventual conclusion was that the ship had been scuttled. So there's a significant commercial case turning on the metadata in a photograph, in addition to those many cases you come across where the state of a pavement that somebody tripped over or the state of a flat that somebody occupied, purportedly according to the photographs, was actually derived from photographs taken a long time before or after the event, and therefore actually no use whatsoever as evidence. So metadata can either confirm or can undermine what appears to be in the photograph, but it's at least as often, at least as important as what appears on the face of the picture.
Chris, to your point, obviously you're talking about how the metadata can inform the timeline of events. But another aspect of that is, of course, now you can have multiple sources of digital evidence, which will also be really important in telling the story of what has happened. And I think that we're all very familiar now with getting the emails, having a look at those, perhaps particularly at a sort of early stage of proceedings to get a sense of what's happened. But it's also very important to get hold as soon as possible of the text messages that the parties may have exchanged, or call notes, or if there are call recordings, possibly those as well, to have as fulsome a timeline as possible. Because otherwise, of course, the risk is that you can review the emails, give advice and views based upon those, but there are actually other digital evidence sources that need to be considered, which will have, you know, quite a significant impact upon that timeline. And I think one thing I've had experience of is that although collecting text messages and messages from various messaging platforms is fairly common, it's not as common as doing it for emails. And where you're doing it remotely, as particularly in the current working environment is the case, that does often require individuals to have backed up their messages, backed up their messaging apps, for example. So it's not always quite as straightforward as doing the email collection. And then you can find yourself in a situation where you've got the emails, but you're still waiting on the messages, the text messages, the messaging app messages. And actually, both of those are really important for getting the full timeline. So I think it's just something to be aware of. There could be multiple sources that need to sort of feed into this timeline before you can have more certainty about what may have happened and advise accordingly.
It's also worth pointing out, I think, that the technology and promoting technology is one of the things I do. So it's unsurprising that I should mention it, but the technology has advanced considerably in the last 12 to 18 months for both collection and for serving up all these documents from all these sources, whether they be text or emails or whatever, in a single timeline so that you can review them in the way that you suggest. And it's as significant, to my eye, to be able to remember to ask about these things as it is to know that the technology exists that allows you to do the review. They're both components of doing the job properly.
And I think that's getting the timeline right and highlighting what might be absent from your collection is almost as important as what is there. Obviously, that's before you even get onto sort of the phenomenon of these disappearing messages, which auto-expire after sort of a set period. And another policy nightmare, I imagine, for those responsible for preservation, if you receive one of those and it's a key contract term, you've got a very short period to take your screenshot or make sure it's secured properly.
The other point, I think, and this is runs not counter to the earlier technology point, but is something not to be forgotten, a focus, old-fashioned looking at stuff to see if it hangs together with the eye and the brain, is something that people tend to forget. It's not just a matter of delegating all this to technology and saying, go find us the gaps or tell us the interesting things. Document review really does need someone to cast a brain upon it and see if it hangs together as a story.
And that's crucial, I think, from our perspective, where we are trying to piece together the story, as you said, and it's often years later, memories fade. So someone, a witness can say, oh no, we must have had a call in between those messages to explain the change or the gap or what happened. And if the other side says, well, no, nothing happened, this is what happened, it's sort of thinking laterally, using the brain to work out, okay, well, do call records exist? The simple existence of a line item on your mobile phone bill or the internal logs to say, oh, well, here is the point to say, we can't say what was in that call. There is no recording. There are no notes. But the fact of a call taking place can become quite important.
I once had to use that line reference from a telephone bill to prove that I'd left the US, where those when they used to tear out a little green form, they'd failed to do it. Could I prove that I'd left? And I did it eventually by showing my last call in the Vodafone bill made from New York and the first call 8 hours later from Heathrow, which seemed to satisfy them. So yes, those line entries simply recording the existence of a call can be worth it.
That also reminds me, Ed, of I think something you touched on the previous Sidebar podcast episode, which is that one of the offerings that we solicitors have against AI is that hopefully we're intuitive and probing. And so with reference to what Chris was saying about the technology gets you so far, but it does also require you to look at what it's showing you and think about it, as you say, kind of laterally as well as anything else. And that's hopefully a bit of a value add that we do that. That's an important part of what we're offering.
And I think that has been picked up throughout this first season of the podcast, is that technology is evolving, it's changing. We don't necessarily know where it's going, but it certainly is a tool which assists but needs to be used properly and without just delegating that responsibility to it. And so, Jesse, with that sort of future gazing thoughts in mind, have you got any thoughts on sort of how these updates, Chris has touched on the sort of how the review platform sort of pieces this all together. How do you think that'll feed through to sort of the presentation of evidence in witness statements and ultimately at court?
Yeah, it's an interesting point to think about. I think particularly because we've just had, as of literally a few days ago, changes to witness evidence rules in the business and property courts, which in summary is, I think, really a kind of attempt by the court to reduce the lawyerly input to factual witness statements and try and ensure first that factual witness statements really only talk about what the witness knew and saw at the time by reference to documents, or let's say evidence, which they were involved at the time, and sort of preserving their recollection very much on that basis so that is all they talk to, and also avoiding having long tracts of documents quoted in their evidence, which is often a sort of advocacy tool, which I think the courts are very keen for factual witnesses to steer well clear of. And I think maybe an overriding sense of some of these rule changes is that it represents a desire on the court's part. Almost, I mean, it's not going this far, but it's towards where evidence was given in chief and you were examined in court as opposed to providing long witness statements, which, as we know, are very long pieces of work and perhaps haven't provided the court with the factual record they're looking for. So perhaps with that examination in chief kind of tone in mind, it will be interesting to see whether a development, including in light of the kind of digital evidence sources, is more a model of factual evidence being a digital exhibit, including perhaps the odd video call, video recording, who knows? This is obviously looking into the future. And with the witness giving their recollection as to their involvement in those communications as part of their evidence, and perhaps doing that in chief. I mean, perhaps witness statements will become significantly slimmed down and the recollection will be given orally, as was the case a long time ago. Yeah, I mean, that's the potential. Alternatively, I mean, the giving evidence in chief might be a step too far, but certainly witness statements being much more a focused recollection of the digital evidence being presented in the exhibit, that may well be a first step before we get there.
I think interactive media exhibits is an interesting point because it does pick up on how you have to collect multiple sources and then present them rather than it being a printed page in a long exhibit, whether it actually tells the story better. If it is a sort of almost as if you were watching your iPhone with the a message gets sent, then the dot, dot, dot appears as the person's responding. And then there's that evidence of a conversation, but the conversation was taking place versus then there's a pause of a day or two till the next message, which doesn't necessarily come through in paper exhibit, especially when you feed in sort of the emails and how you switch. And then there was a phone call and how you switch between them. And so, Chris, I suppose, do you have any sort of closing remarks to bring us to a conclusion as to how you see the explosion of data, how it's changing disclosure and disputes?
The level I still think is important is the policy level. What organizations have done, whether they be law firms or any other company, to make sure that people follow rules, that the rules aren't too constraining, but nevertheless allow the tracing of conversations, of negotiations, or whatever, that at the very least they know if stuff's being recorded, and if so, where and how to retrieve it, seems to me to be something fairly fundamental that may have got lost in the excitement of a sudden moving out of the office. Allied to that is a point that's recurred through this conversation to do with the lawyers remembering to ask. Whether you've got the technology to deal with it is a separate question, but if you don't even remember to ask, what other forms of communication did you use? Oh, what I see, WhatsApp, you didn't tell us about that. Those sorts of things. If you don't remember to ask, you don't get into discussions about whether it's proportionate to do anything about it. Beyond that, I see a collision, and perhaps we always have foreseen a collision, between ever-growing volumes, and they're growing at even greater rates than they have been growing hitherto, and the need to achieve a litigation result or a regulatory result proportionately. It becomes very difficult to see how we're going to do that without some major adjustment in both the rules and the requirements of regulators. The move has been, the growth has been so great in the last 12 to 15 months. I find it hard to see how we're going to resolve that.
I think if there's one point that I'd like to endorse from this whole podcast, and I think Jesse would agree, hopefully, is that if clients could have these policies in place now, it will make our job a lot easier and hopefully achieve a better result for them as well. So it's sort of win-win all round.
That's really why I linked those things in my conclusion, that how you prepare as an organization leads through to how you can adequately and proportionately collate it all. At the end, there is a direct link. You can make life easier for your lawyers to win for you.
That's it for episode 6 of the Future of Litigation season of Sidebar. Many thanks to Chris and Jesse for taking part and sharing their unique insights on evidence in the digital age. Thank you for listening to Sidebar season 1, and watch out for season 2 coming soon.
Thank you for listening to Sidebar. Tune into our next episode by subscribing now and have the inside track on the latest legal issues and trends in business, law, and society and what they mean for your future.